today we're looking at the 37th president of the United States, Richard Milhouse Nixon. And this for me is now me having an understanding as a child, first of all, in 1968, I'm about 7 years old. The Democratic National Convention is going on in my hometown of Chicago, blocks away from where I was growing up, watching my father's face as he's watching the news and what is going on with the violence outside the convention center there in Chicago, and seeing his concern, that leaves a mark on you. And then in 72, when McGovern and Nixon are running against one another, and it's an opportunity for him to be reelected, and I'm given an assignment, we all are as a class in sixth grade by Miss Carter, to do a report on the election. And so I'm going around Chicago with my father and going to like the Republican headquarters where they're handing out pins and stickers and bumper stickers and literature on Nixon, and then going to the Democratic one, and then putting something together and getting into discussions with my friends, and finding out that there is emotional responses. I remember saying to Norman Nithman, because his family was going to be voting for George McGovern, and my father had said McGovern was a communist, and I remember just saying that to Norman and him wanting to fight me, and I don't even know what a communist is, but I'm responding to something that my father had said. And so putting that together, and then later coming home to the congressional hearings about Watergate, trying to figure out what that is, hearing about this term impeachment, wondering what that means. And all of these things are in my seventh grade, eighth grade memories, and ultimately him resigning from the office. And so this is something that left a mark on me. I was growing up and learning that this thing of politics and what would happen to someone in our country. We don't have kings. We don't have rulers as other countries do. We have a president that's elected. And so trying to figure out this person who my father had voted for, who it was looked at as a someone that was good, and then this happened. And so to understand what that means. Well, let's look at him for a little bit here. He's born January 9th, 1913 in Yorba Linda, California. And what's he most known for? As we start out each time, we're looking at these little facts concerning each of these individuals. But Richard Nixon is most known for being the only president to resign from office as a result of that Watergate scandal. But he's also known for ending the Vietnam War and improving United States relations with the Soviet Union and China. He grew up the son of a grocer in Southern California. His family was poor, and he had a fairly difficult childhood that included two of his brothers dying from illness. He was smart, though, and wanted to go to college, and he paid his way through Whittier College, working nights at his father's grocery store. He enjoyed debate, sports, and drama while in college, and he also earned a full scholarship to attend Duke University Law School in North Carolina. After graduating from Duke, he moved back home and began practicing law, and when World War II broke out, he joined the Navy and served in the Pacific Theater of the War, where he rose to the rank of Lieutenant Commander before leaving the Navy in 1946. After leaving the Navy, he decided to enter politics, and he first ran for the United States House of Representatives and won a seat in the 1946 elections. And 4 years later, he ran for Senate and won that election as well. And he gained a reputation in Congress for being anti-communist, and this made him popular with the public. Well, in 1952, Dwight D. Eisenhower selected Richard Nixon to be his running mate for president. And Nixon served as Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years, where he was one of the most active vice presidents in United States history. And in many ways, Nixon redefined the job of vice president, doing far more than other vice presidents before him. He attended national security and cabinet meetings and even ran several of these meetings when Eisenhower was unable to attend. And when Eisenhower had a heart attack and was unable to work for 6 weeks, Nixon effectively ran the country. And he also helped shepherd legislation such as the Civil Rights Act of 1957 through Congress and traveled the world conducting foreign affairs. Well, he ran for president in 1960 and lost to John F. Kennedy. He then tried to run for governor of California and lost, and he retired from politics after that and went to work on Wall Street in New York. And in 1968, he ran for president again, and this time he won. And although his presidency is going to be forever marked by the Watergate scandal, there were many other major events and accomplishments during his presidency, and they include this, the man on the moon. Neil Armstrong became the first man to walk on the moon on July 21st, 1969, and Nixon spoke to the astronauts during their historic moonwalk. He also is famous for that visit to China. Communist China had become a closed country, not meeting with the United States, and Nixon managed to visit Chairman Mao and opened up important future relations with China. Concerning the Vietnam War, Nixon ended the United States' involvement in the Vietnam War with the Paris Peace Accords of 1973. U.S. troops were pulled out of Vietnam. And then with the treaty with the Soviet Union, he also made a historic visit to the Soviet Union, meeting their leader, Leonid Brezhnev, and signing two very important treaties, the SALT One Treaty and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Both were an effort to reduce arms and the chance of World War III. Well, in 1972, five men were caught breaking into the Democratic Party headquarters in the Watergate buildings in Washington, D.C. And it turned out that these men were working for what is thought of now the Nixon administration. Nixon denied any knowledge of the break-in. He said that his employees had done this without his permission. However, later tapes were discovered that recorded Nixon discussing the break-ins. He clearly had knowledge of them, at least later, and had lied about that. The Congress was getting ready to impeach Nixon, and it was believed that the Senate had the votes to get him out of office. And instead of going through this brutal trial, Nixon resigned, and Vice President Gerald Ford became president. Well, he died from a stroke in 1994, and there were five presidents that were present at his funeral, including Bill Clinton, George Bush, Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, and Gerald Ford. Some fun facts about him. He was once offered the position of players' representative in Major League Baseball. He turned it down to continue in politics. His name appeared on five national ballots. He received more total votes over those five elections than any other American politician in history. He's the only person born and raised in California to become president, and it was during his administration that the voting age was lowered from 21 to 18. President Gerald Ford pardoned Nixon of any crimes he may have committed, and while he was still lying about the Watergate scandal, he made the famous statement, "I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got." And he was very musical and played the violin in his high school orchestra. He also played the piano. Well, let's take a look at some of the items just concerning him growing up and what that looked like in the area of its impact on him. And then we ultimately move toward where he was at spiritually. But Richard Milhouse Nixon was born January 9th, 1913 on a farm in Yorba Linda, California, where his father raised lemons. His mother was, as he later described, a gentle Quaker mother with a passionate concern for peace, who reared her five sons as Quakers and imbued them with peaceful ideals. When Dick was 9 years old, the family moved to Whittier, California. There, his father opened a combination gasoline station and general store where the brothers worked when they were not in school. And during his school years, Dick Nixon took part in many activities and attained excellent grades as well. He was a leading member of the debate teams both in high school and college, and he was winning prizes for public speaking. He acted in plays, performed on the organ at the Quaker Meeting House, and the piano at parties. And he was elected to various school offices, including president of the college student body. And when he graduated from Whittier College in 1934, he stood second in his class. He continued his education at the Duke University Law School in Durham, North Carolina. He had been awarded a tuition scholarship and helped pay the rest of his expenses by doing research for the dean for 35 cents an hour. And when he graduated from Duke in 1937, he was third in his class. Upon graduation from law school, Nixon returned to California, passed the state bar exam, and joined a law firm in Whittier. And one of his special interests was acting in an amateur theater group. There he was introduced to Thelma Catherine Pat Ryan, a red-haired high school typing teacher. He proposed to her the night they met, but she refused him for 2 years. They finally married on June 21st, 1940, when they were both 27 years old, and later had two daughters, Patricia, or Tricia, and Julie. And after Nixon had been elected president in 1968, his daughter Julie married David Eisenhower, the grandson of the president Eisenhower. And in 1971, Tricia married E.F. Cox in a White House Rose Garden wedding. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941, Nixon left his law practice to take part in the war effort. He went to Washington and obtained a $61 a week job doing legal work in the Office of Price Administration. But after a few months, he decided that despite his Quaker background, he should help more directly to fight the war. And so he applied for and received a Navy commission as a lieutenant in September of 1942. The following year, he was sent to the South Pacific as operations officer for a Navy air transport unit. And after 15 months on islands and coral atolls, he returned to shore duty in the United States, advancing to the rank of lieutenant commander by the time the war was over. And we see this all from the book, The American Presidents, by David Whitney. Well, specifically from a biography entitled Richard Nixon, The Life, John A. Farrell gives us an understanding of what it was like growing up with the Nixon or Milhouse name. He says this: the Milhouse clan was from a rare sort of immigrant stock. Irish Quakers, the Society of Friends, as they called themselves, were individualistic and anti-clerical. They believed that every person could forge a private relationship with the divine without the yoke of priests or popes. The early Friends were pacifists and abolitionists and laborers for social justice. They wore plain clothes, abhorred music and dance and other frivolities, and kept their own plain manner of speaking, using thee and thy instead of you and your. William Penn's colony served as the faith's American foothold, and it was to the southeast Pennsylvania that Thomas and Sarah Milhouse of Timihoe, Ireland, migrated in 1729. Over the year, the Milhouses trekked the same trail as the Nixons, making their way across the Allegheny Mountains to the rich fields of the Midwest. They too were quietly industrious. The first noteworthy shoots were Joshua and Elizabeth Milhouse, Indiana nurseryman, and his wife, notably because their lives served as the inspiration for The Friendly Persuasion, a fictional account of rural Quaker life written by a great-granddaughter, Jessamine West. It tells the story of a Quaker family struggling with the modern versus the traditional and the challenge of pacifism during the Civil War. Time and westward migration transformed the Quakers. Though some kept to the old ways, others embraced the trappings, preachers, choirs and steeples, and doctrines of American Protestantism. They abandoned their social ministry and became more materialistic and self-satisfied. It was rather a pity, Westwood writes, skewering her family's smugness, that there had to be, for biological reason, an admission of non-Milhouse blood into our life stream. Franklin Milhouse, the oldest son of Joshua and Elizabeth, grew prosperous in the family nursery business in Indiana. His first wife bore two children before dying. He remarried to the sturdier Almira Burge, and in 1897, they completed the clan's transcontinental passage, arriving in the new Quaker colony of Whittier, some 20 miles east of Los Angeles. They were midlife adventurers looking for sunshine and hoping to cash in on the latest California boom. It was abroad in those days, the notion to move out, Jasmine recalled, to go west. Well, we see even further as we look at the biography by Elizabeth Drew entitled Richard M. Nixon, that we learn a little bit about him personally as we want to understand this man. So he's got these Quaker roots, and we'll probably talk about that a little bit more in a little bit, but what kind of man did he grow up to be? Well, some of Nixon's close aides, she writes, thought that he was several people, polite and generous, thoughtful and impetuous, capable of exercising some progressive instincts, a hating, vindictive, crude man. He needed and sought a great deal of flattery. His rages caused his aides to cower and hope that they would blow over. If a staff member did try to challenge his prejudices or dark side, Nixon would cut that person off. This explains a lot of what happened later in his presidency. Indecisive as he often was, Nixon could also make big and sometimes courageous decisions on foreign policy. He prided himself on this. But it was Henry Kissinger later who said, a joyless, desperate courage affected by his fatalistic instinct that nothing he touched would ever be crowned with success. John Ehrlichman wrote in his memoir, Nixon liked foreign affairs better. Domestic controversy involved the unsolvable, passion-laden issues no one could enjoy grappling with, and the damnable special interest groups would always demand and demand more but never show gratitude. Nixon liked the pomp as well as the substance of foreign policy. Ehrlichman said, foreign policy activities, ambassadors ceremonially presenting their credentials or the exchange of toasts at a summit conference with the Russians, all massage a president's ego. Whereas a visit to the sewage plant didn't make Nixon feel like the leader of the free world. But parenthetically, it says, he also pointed out that Nixon did make such trips. So with his idea for pomp, in 1970, Nixon put his own personal stamp on how the White House was presented. White House guards were dressed up in this comic opera costumes, tunics, gold epaulets, and tall hats. And amid the public laughter, the uniforms re-retired. And another Nixonian innovation, smartly uninformed, uniformed trumpeters, their medieval horns dressed in heraldry, announced the approach of the chief executive. So he wanted to be respected. He wanted to be looked at as somebody that was worthy of that respect. Well, Ben Stein, if you remember Ben Stein, he was in the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and he's that teacher that's asking a question. But he was also an individual that understood politics. He's a writer, an actor, he's an economist and lawyer, and he was close to the Nixon family. He had opportunity to be in meetings with Nixon, and he would say that in cabinet meetings, there was a side of Nixon, and Stein would look at himself as a friend of the Nixon family. In this book entitled The Peacemaker, Nixon, the man, president, and my friend. So we see somebody that's actually going to talk positively about Nixon. Said this, occasionally, rarely, I was invited to cabinet meetings. I would sit in a chair on the edge of the room. I was not expected to speak at the meetings, and I didn't. Most Americans do not get to attend cabinet meetings, and I thought I was blessed indeed to see this major phenomenon of American democracy at work. And several things emerged from those meetings to take lodge in my memories. First of all, Mr. Nixon had a superb sense of humor. At one point in the larger world, statistics started to indicate, sadly, that he might be heading for a bout of inflation, even as we were also heading into an economic slowdown. And that was a major political problem, to put it mildly. Nixon, well, we'll have to appoint a commission to study the whole issue, Mr. Nixon said. That will solve the problem. I assume you're kidding, said someone whose name he doesn't recall. We all know that these commissions accomplish nothing at all. It's just a way of avoiding questions for a few weeks. I know that, Mr. Nixon said. I've been in this game for a while now. But can you tell people you expect any concrete results? Asked the same man. Of course we can, Nixon said. Honesty may not be the best policy, but it's worth trying once in a while. And so there's laughter in the room. And Nixon, who liked being liked, isn't that interesting? He liked being liked. He smiled. And then this other man, later, as he's talking, he goes, there's a suggestion about reissuing guidelines that have been controversial. And this other man in the room says, Mr. President, you can't walk on water twice. And the president looked serious and replied, you can if it's frozen. So more laughter, and the president liked that too. So we see in Stein's book an understanding that this is still a man. This is still a man that wants to be liked, that wants to be appreciated. He's trying to figure out how to get people to like him, because we look back in his history, and he's a loner. He's at times, as a child, they said that he would be laying on the grass just looking up at the sky, and he didn't have a lot of friends, and probably was trying to figure out, how do I make friends? Well, in the book, Religion in the Oval Office by Gary Scott Smith, talking about the religious lives of American president, it says this. It says, from childhood, Nixon wrote in his college essays, he had been taught that the Bible was the only true book, the perfect book that explained everything people needed to know. His college education had convinced Nixon that the Bible was not inerrant, but his faith in its fundamental teachings remained intact. The Bible was man's finest record of religious writings and had inspired millions to strive for the highest values. And as a politician, Nixon publicly praised Scripture, and in 1962 article in Decision magazine, he insisted that Americans needed more preaching from the Bible and to know what the Bible says to our time. And as president, he testified to the ever-present influence of the Bible in his life. It motivated millions to serve others, helped them cope with trying times, and supplied courage, compassion, charity, and peace. And the Word of God also proved solace for despairing people. Many statesmen, he avowed, had drawn inspiration from Holy Writ. He urged Americans to let the timeless wisdom of the Book of Books guide their daily lives. So we see in this man's heart an understanding, a desire of wanting to be someone that is spiritual, but still leaning into his most his wisdom. And in the book The Presidents by Ian Dale, it talks about his legacy. Sadly, the most lasting legacy of Nixon may be the toxic political culture he inadvertently created. The dreaded imperial presidency, the overreaching executive branch, took on greater form under his watch. And Watergate warped American politics permanently. Distrust of Congress and government became permanently fashionable, posturing as an outsider and making over-emotional appeals to the public sentiment became a necessity for anyone seeking high office. And worst of all, thanks to Nixon, the press became even more astronomically self-important and obsessed with its role as guardian of democracy. In the book All the President's Men, we see a couple of journalists taking him down. And so, having brought down the most popular presidential winner in history, the hacks of Washington felt that they could do it again and again. And that's why every scandal, however silly, is now a dash gate. It's why impeachment and the threat of impeachment has become a cheap political weapon. And for half a century, the shadow of Watergate has hung over America, and it still lingers. Well, we dig into the books that specifically talk about, by John M. Wiley, The Faith of the Presidents. And it talks about the fact that he grew up in a deeply religious environment. His parents were devout evangelical Quakers who followed strictly to their sacred norms, which included regular prayer times and personal disciplines of avoiding alcohol, gambling, and foul language. Nixon was actively involved in church ministries even as a youth, having played piano, sung in the church choir, and while in college, he taught a Sunday school class. And according to his own account, he believed in the literal correctness of the Bible, the miracles, even the whale story. For most onlookers at that time, they would probably have thought rather highly of Nixon's spiritual state. But that all changed while ironically studying at the Quaker institution, Whittier College. He studied under J. Herschel Coffin, whose lectures, The Philosophy of Christian Construction, shattered his faith in the Bible and in historic doctrines of Christianity. And it's also noteworthy that his older brother, Harold, who had suffered from the effects of tuberculosis, died at the young age of 23, right around Richard Nixon's crisis of faith. And while Nixon had abandoned his former views, he still held on to certain beliefs, as stated in his own essays. I still believe that God is the creator. I still believe that he lives today in some form, directing the destinies of the cosmos. For the time being, I shall accept the solution offered by Kant that man can only go so far in his research and explanations, and from that point on, we must accept God. Thus, he was no atheist, but he certainly wasn't any longer a Christian, though he classified himself as one, professing more so the moral teachings of Jesus than the divine evidences. So we lastly look at the book, The Presidents and Their Faith, by Grinder and Shaw. And we see that in his second inaugural address on January 20th, 1973, Nixon stated this: "As we meet here today, we stand on the threshold of a new era of peace in the world. The central question before us is, how shall we use that peace?" He would conclude his speech by declaring, "We shall answer to God, to history, and to our conscience for the way in which we use these years." The Nixon years, what one scholar has not without reason called the era of Nixon, are likely always to be rated as consequential. China, United States-Soviet relations, Vietnam, the Middle East and Latin America, and then controversial, Watergate, the plumbers, dirty tricksters, the enemies list. Nixon may go down as one of his aides opined as the permanent unknown of American politics. And throughout his presidency, Nixon wrote self-improvement notes to himself, notes that at the least border on secularized versions of guides to better Quaker faith in action. One he wrote in November 1970 reads, "I have learned about myself and the presidency. From this experience, I conclude the primary contribution a president can make is on spiritual lift, not material solutions." He explored other lessons learned and then wrote of the need for spiritual lift each Sunday. Nixon would pursue such a rift not by venturing out of the White House to worship with local congregation or take part in a local Quaker meeting house, as Herbert Hoover often did as a Quaker. Rather, Nixon brought the church inside the White House, beginning on January 26, 1969, with Sunday services held in the East Room, with Nixon approving the program and actually acting as master of ceremonies as Billy Graham preached and George Beverly Shea sang. And so we see a man that wants control. And that's what will not be allowed by our Lord. You cannot dictate to God how things are going to be. And so we see a man that hurt and lost so much because he would not let go and lean into Christ as the ultimate control.